This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Al Barna and Randall Ann Homan. They co-authored the book San Francisco Neon. Great having you on the show.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
So you're co-authors. Are you both the official co-authors, or are there a number of other people? I know on the main website there's four people listed.
We're the photographers and the authors, but we had two great essays written.
Yeah, we had an essay written by Thomas Downs and another one written by Eric Linksweiler.
And he's from MONA, which is the Museum of Neon Art.
In San Francisco.
It's in Glendale, California. That's where the Museum of Neon Art is. And it's a fabulous place. And Eric also does the bus tours for MONA, and he was definitely a big inspiration for us to do this book.
Can you talk about how both of you got interested in neon? Are you both Bay Area natives?
No, I actually grew up in Pennsylvania, Wilkes-Barre, Scranton area.
And I'm from Arizona, but we both came to San Francisco to be art students in the 70s.
And we, I think we both individually have always had a soft spot for neon, and at a certain point Randall realized that a lot of my photography, you know, street photography and portfolio things, tended to have a lot of neon in the photos, you know, incidental, but at a certain point we said, you know what, these signs here in San Francisco, the signs in your photographs have disappeared, why don't we record what's left before they're all gone? So that was the genesis of the book.
And I think there was one sign in particular we couldn't believe that it came down. And it was on Mission, I think it was on 26, right? Or
22nd.
Is that Mission District?
In the Mission District, yeah. And it was the Hunt's Donut sign. And it just doesn't get better than donuts falling out of the sky, splashing into a neon cup of coffee. It was a beautiful sign and an icon of the neighborhood. And we just came around the corner one day and it was gone. And that really, I think, lit a fire under. So we had to start documenting things before they disappeared.
Right.
And I'm sure when you first visited San Francisco, there was a lot more.
So much.
There was a considerable amount of neon that has disappeared since the early our early years in the city.
In some ways, you could say when we got to San Francisco in this, you know, mid-70s, it still felt like the town where Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy lived. It really had that 50s feel.
We kind of caught the tail end of that.
When did the book come out, and can you talk about the process of making the book, especially the photography?
Okay, the book came out in
December 2014.
Right, we worked on it for about 5 years. It took a long time to make those photographs and to get, you know, the quality of image that we wanted. You would go and plan your whole evening around photographing a certain sign only to find out that it had been damaged in a windstorm or it shorted out. So you'd have to come back some other night. So it took a while.
And then we started to get to know some of the business owners who own the signs, and we worked to try to convince them to fix the signs so we could get a really nice portrait of them. And sometimes they listened, sometimes they didn't. It's interesting that some owners just love their sign and really want to take care of it, and some owners kind of forget that they even have one.
Well, and another thing about working on the book for 5 years. We're, fortunately, Randall's a designer, And so she did the whole book design, the layout, and then, you know, we worked on sequencing the photographs where we needed to. And, we have some thumbnail images in the back of the book with descriptions of the signs and maybe a little background on the signs. So it took a little while to complete all of that.
Yeah, anytime we could have a little story or background to the sign, we put it in the appendix in the back. But we really had the luxury, by taking our time to lay it out, to go back and reshoot so that really the whole sequence of the book, each two photos on either side of the page are meant to go together. It's not random at all.
And you also do neon walking tours. How does that work, and what areas do you focus on?
Well, the first one we did was for a great group called, they have a great name, called the Society for Experiential Graphic Design. And those are people who design wayfinding systems. And they were having a year of neon where they really were interested in focusing on neon signs, possibly for wayfinding. So we decided to take them through a little tour in San Francisco, and it quickly became evident that Chinatown has the most and the oldest signs. And not only that, it's got some of the best stories behind them. So that's always been the keystone of the tours that we give, that Chinatown walking tour. It's pretty fascinating, great way to see Chinatown in a completely different way by looking up. You just see these layers of history. And we did that Chinatown tour a couple times, and people kept writing to us and saying, when's your next tour? When are you guys going to do a different one? And so now it's 3 years later, and we do five separate tours through different neighborhoods in the city. And I don't think there's another city in America where you can do five separate two-hour walking tours about neon signs.
Would you say San Francisco has the highest concentration of neon in America outside of Vegas, of course?
Well, only because it's a concentrated city. It certainly doesn't have the most signs, but maybe the most signs in the smallest geographical area.
Could be. We're 49 square miles here, but yeah. You know that Chicago has a lot of neons. Portland, Oregon is a really good neon town.
San Diego, I mean, and then, you know, the greater L.A. Area just has fabulous stuff, but it's not necessarily concentrated, so you can't really do a walking tour, which is why the Museum of Neon Art does a bus tour.
Yeah, I'm from L.A. There's definitely some great signs, but it's so spread out. There's not, like, one area. Maybe there's a few in the Sunset Strip, a couple in Broadway in downtown L.A. There's some signs that are still in existence, but they're not lit up. But for the most part, there's some great signs in L.A., but it's so spread out.
Yeah, well, you know, actually on Broadway in Los Angeles, they've been restoring signs at some of the old movie theaters. And it's been a great project and a big success. And that's just in the last few years, but that's pretty exciting. And then the Museum of Neon Art is partnered in that venture. And it was a city councilman who actually spearheaded the whole movement to do the restorations.
Would you say that the peak of neon signs in San Francisco was the Art Deco era, basically the 30s, or also the 50s as well?
Well, it's interesting design-wise. You know, in the 30s, who could afford a neon sign? A big movie palace, big movie theaters. They were bigger businesses. But after World War II, actually, this is kind of interesting. Going back to school to learn the craft of neon was something you could do on the GI Bill. So there were a lot of guys that came back from World War II and learned to design and build neon signs. And so that was the heyday for neon signs for mom and pop businesses. And that's still a lot of what exists today in San Francisco, as well as a number of the movie theaters. But when you look at a neon sign now in San Francisco, it almost always signals a small business.
Very few corporations have neon signs in this town.
Does the book just focus on San Francisco or the entire Bay Area?
Just San Francisco.
I know you do post that picture of Market Street, and mid-Market Street especially had a high concentration of signage. I heard a few years back there was some proposal for a mid-market sign district, but that was voted down.
No, that's a great postcard that was photographed by Ed Christensen, and we do show that a lot because it helps us know how much we lost. And there's only one of those signs left, and that's the Oddfellows. I think there have been different proposals of what to do about Market Street, but very little agreement.
Yeah, and that the proposal you're speaking of, that just kind of faded.
Yeah, I've walked down that stretch. It's an area that's slightly seedy, but they're gentrifying it with the Twitter headquarters. I think the only neon sign I saw was a kind of a sleazy strip club.
Yeah, yeah. Right in that section, yeah. You'd have to get off of Market Street to see the neon. And, you know, they're lurking a few blocks over, but on that section of Market Street, you're right, there isn't much.
And a lot of that was when they dug the tunnel to put in the underground BART and Mew system. All of those businesses just kind of had died and withered away, and their signs went with them.
There is a decent number of signs still around Union Square. There's the Tad Steakhouse. There's a couple hotel signs. I think the most beautiful one is the one at the Sir Francis Drake Hotel for the Starlet Lounge, which is Art Deco. I noticed the last time I visited, it wasn't lit up. Do you know the status of that sign, and can you talk about the Union Square area?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mention that, because we had a tour the other night, and the Star now has a really feeble attempt to illuminate it with some blue LED lighting. But when the chain that took over that hotel, the most recent owner, they just decided not to light the Star, and they also have a beautiful dining and dancing sign. It's in the shape of a fountain that's dining and dancing on the same building. And those are real landmarks on Union Square, and they're dark.
But they're still there. So if basically, you know, the sign itself, even though the neon doesn't turn on or might need repair, but as long as the metal cabinet or the structures there, it can always be restored.
So you don't think it's in danger of being destroyed? They're just not lighting it up?
Exactly. It's a lot of money to take those big, big signs down, not to mention serious permitting.
And there's some other signs on Powell Street. I can't keep track of all of them off the top of my head. I know there's Tad's Steakhouse.
And right. I think there's the Stratford Hotel.
Oh, right.
Right around the corner from Powell on Ellis is John's Grill, and that's a landmark.
Also, another sign that's been restored in the last few years is the Herbert Hotel, which is pretty much across the street from Tad Steaks.
You might be remembering also a beautiful canopy wraparound sign that was Marquardt Cigar Store. And that was beautiful and a landmark, and just one day all the glass was gone and it was painted black. But we did hear from Aero Sign Company that the owners have already engaged the Aero Sign Company to create a new design, and they want to attract a tenant who has to come with a really great retro sign design to really bring that canopy back as a landmark in Union Square. So we're looking forward to see what great ideas somebody has for that and what the new tenant will be that really fits that storefront. I think right now, I mean, for a while it's just been a sunglasses or
a hat shop,
yeah.
I think I know what you're talking about with the newspaper signage.
Yeah, it had a little clock at the top, and it was a wraparound canopy. Really, really iconic. And
with, yeah, the clock cool. Was trimmed with lettering that said New York Times.
You're saying they completely destroyed it, or they just altered it?
They took off the glass, and they painted it black. But the canopy itself has been restored. There's little finials on it that have been restored by by metal craftsmen. So the Aero Sign Company has been working on the structure and the frame. They're just waiting for a new design to go with a new tenant. But it's always great when an owner realizes that they have something special that's attached to the building. And, you know, the dime drops and they like, oh, this is something that's good that will attract a tenant and will bring customers into the store. I mean, that's what neon signs do so well.
Right, and we've actually seen that happen with a recent restoration in San Francisco, the Avenue Theater on San Bruno Avenue. They decided to restore the neon, the marquee, and the vertical blade sign. to its original splendor. And sure enough, it is attracting tenant interest. So, because the theater is no longer used as a theater, but they use the neon, the allure of the neon, to attract tenants, and it seems to be working.
Yeah, we just there's an ice cream place is gonna there's two storefronts in the front of the theater, so one of them is going to be ice cream, and maybe the other one will be popcorn. I don't know.
One thing I've noticed, and I think you have a photograph of this in one of for your book cover on your blog, is a lot of the parking garages near Union Square have neon signs on them, and that's something you usually don't see in a parking garage.
Oh yeah, those tall blades that say parking. And if you look at old photo, you know historic photos of San Francisco, you'll see they went in pretty early. And of course, everybody driving around Union Square, they're looking for parking, so they really had to advertise to pull people in. It's also interesting that, you know, most of Union Square burnt to the ground, that whole area, in the 06 earthquake. And it was rebuilt, you know, all kind of within the same decade. And it was really important that the garages be beautiful. And there's actually a book out called The Beautiful Garages of San Francisco. And if you look, they were kind of built almost to look like train stations. And as soon as neon signs became available, they got attached to almost all of the garages.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. I mean, usually parking garages are ugly in most cities, but there's a lot of really beautiful ones. Are these mostly from the 1940s?
Earlier.
No, earlier, because they were built, most of them, after the 06 earthquake, so they were built, you know, between 06 and the 20s.
Right, and for instance, in our book, you'll see a photograph of the Palace Garage, which is not on Union Square, but it's not far from the square, and that was built in 1921. And it's also, you know, graced with some beautiful, beautiful neon.
It's a highlight of our downtown tour, the Palace Garage.
I know the Tenderloin area nearby is an area that a lot of tourists avoid, and it has a reputation for being dangerous, but there is a high concentration of some beautiful older signs, some hotel signs, and also liquor store signs. It kind of, that area has a feeling of how I would imagine Times Square being in the 1970s.
Yes, although the Tenderloin is changing. There's a great museum in the Tenderloin, called the Tenderloin Museum, which celebrates the history and the diversity of that whole neighborhood. And they're involved in neon sign restoration. So we've been working with the Tenderloin Museum and the city of San Francisco to create a survey and complete a survey. We do condition reports on signs in the Tenderloin to determine which ones are the most feasible candidates for restoration.
We found about 80 signs just walking the grid, and almost half of them are actually in decent enough shape to be restored. And there's a lot of family life in the Tenderloin. It isn't just all, you know, crime and sin. There's all kinds of people that live in that neighborhood. And as soon as you light up a neon sign on the corner, it just, the vibrancy affects everybody on the street. And it also creates safety at night because the streets aren't as dark. And not to mention neighborhood pride. And we know that there was one place in particular we were in talking with. They had just illuminated the neon sign and had it all restored. We were talking to the owners, and neighbors kept coming in and saying, "You didn't turn your sign on. We always count on that sign going on right at sunset." So people look forward to those signs lighting up at night.
I think a lot of them are hotel signs. Is one of them, you have a picture of the Carlton Hotel?
Yeah, it's not. That's kind of at the gates of the Tenderloin. That's actually up on Post Street.
It's about one block away.
Yeah. Geary is the border for the Tenderloin, so it's two blocks up Larkin.
The neighborhoods change really quickly in San Francisco.
But it is indicative of the type of hotel sign that's very, very prominent in the Tenderloin area.
And there's also I don't know what you would call that area, but the kind of the area where Union Square borders the Tenderloin, I think it's around, is it Mason Street? There's a high concentration of signs along there.
Yeah, and Mason Street on it, I think we'd still, I mean, real, you know, realtors will, but we would think of that as still as being Union Square.
I would, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because the Tenderloin was always where a lot of the single people that worked in the shops in Union Square, that's they lived in the Tenderloin.
And lots of single women.
Mm.
Is the area beginning to gentrify?
Well, certainly the closer you get to Twitter, that's the Twitter line that people call it. And there's starting to be some gentrification. The proper hotel just kind of took a Fleabag hotel and made it into a nice one, put up a neon blade, brand new neon blade.
They've got a rooftop bar and nightclub,
which is pretty popular. So we see gentrification in that particular place. But in general, I would say in the heart of the Tenderloin, it's still very much working class people and people of low opportunity and families who are looking for a bargain because it's so difficult to find housing in San Francisco.
There are a lot of immigrant families. Mm-hmm. There's a strong Vietnamese community.
It's just one of the last places in San Francisco that remains very diverse in a lot of ways, and it's always had that history of not following the rules, and that I think that still goes.
I know on the Embarcadero Center, that's a skyscraper high-rise complex. I noticed in some photographs they have they use neon along the outlines of that.
Those are actually LED bulbs, and they usually light those during the winter season, during the holiday season. And they have a lighting celebration every year, but they're actually light bulbs.
It's interesting when you get really far away from a neon sign and you wonder, is that LED or is it neon? And one way to tell is the consistency of the light. And if it's the color and the brightness is consistent, it's probably LED. Because neon, every neon sign is handmade. And so every letter, every piece of it might vary a little bit. And also the different transformers might be burning a little hotter, a little lower. And that'll create some inconsistency of brightness or color. And we love that inconsistency. It reminds you that it's handmade.
And you'll see color shift in tubes where you have to patch in or splice in a new tube, even if it's the same phosphor-coated tube, same color, it's going to be a little brighter because it's a newer tube.
It's a subtle difference, but it's fun to look for that subtlety.
I've heard that some of the older signs that they've taken neon and transformed it into LED.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a different kind of a light. It's a much colder, harsher light than the visceral glow that you get from neon.
Was that when the Embarcadero Center was built in the 70s, or did they change it from neon?
I think it used to be incandescent bulbs, believe it or not. When they first started to light it, it was before LEDs.
You might be right. Yeah. But that where the Embarcadero Centers are located, that had been the produce market for San Francisco. That's where all of the produce was trucked in from the Central Valley of California into San Francisco in that area. That area looked completely different than it does now because of the Embarcadero Centers.
And it had a lot of, you know, every produce market had a neon sign, and you can still see some of that in a great film called Thieves Highway. Yeah, is that Jules Dassin, I think?
He might have. Yeah. He directed it. It's written by
Bezzaretti.
A.J. Bezzaretti. Yeah. And it gives you a great idea of, and great visuals, because they shot on location at the produce market at the time. I think that movie was made in the early 50s.
And then there's a great sign at the Ferry Building. I think it says Port of San Francisco.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's a landmark. And that's maintained by John Law. He's the neon repairman that has no fear of heights.
Yeah, he maintains some real landmarks in the city. Also, the Hills Brothers coffee sign, which is along the Embarcadero. John takes care of that sign as well. In fact, John, we had a neon conference over the weekend, here in San Francisco, and it's called Neon Speaks, and John Law was the moderator for the symposium.
And probably the highest concentration of neon in San Francisco would be Broadway and North Beach. So you must
not necessarily. I mean, a lot of those signs are gone. I would say Chinatown is denser,
but not illuminated.
Yeah,
necessarily.
But not necessarily illuminated.
Although there are some restoration projects underway for neon in Chinatown, which we're pretty excited about.
Yeah, that was my observation walking around Chinatown, especially at night, is there's such a high concentration of signage, but I'd say only about 10 to 20% of them are lit up, but there's that potential.
Yeah, and there's a program called SF Shines, and it's part of the Invest in Neighborhoods project, and they give matching grants to business owners that want to, you know, basically do something to improve the facade of their business. And there's a real excitement now to give grants to restore neon signs in Chinatown. And they're kind of hoping for one business owner to take the plunge and give it a whirl, and that would influence other owners. And so that is the Lipo sign on Grant Ave. And it's a beautiful Chinese lantern. It's a 3D neon sign. And we're excited to be consultants on that project.
Yeah, they're going to start work on that any day now.
And that will send precedence, so maybe in 20 years the whole area will be completely lit up.
You know, we're going
to
work.
We'd like to see that.
Yeah, we're going to work towards that. I like that goal.
Because I noticed you talk to a lot of historic preservationists. They talk about what's been lost, and there's something kind of missing is looking forward to something optimistic.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting, there's an amazing neon data collector. Well, she's more than that, photographer, historian, Deborah Jane Seltzer, and she's got a website called roadsidearchitecture.com. It's over 2,000 pages, and she has pie charts, she has data. And she also gave a talk at the Neon Symposium about who's lost the most signs of the big cities in America. And Detroit has lost 50% in the 12 years she's been documenting. 18 years she's been documenting.
Right.
San Francisco has only lost 4%. In fact, it came in with the highest score.
And that really surprised us. We assumed, you know, San Francisco had lost at least 50% of
the signage. It's the lowest. I think it's the lowest score. We've lost the least.
Yeah.
I talked to Thomas Rinaldi of New York Neon, who wrote the book New York Neon and runs the blog. He said basically New York has lost most of their signs, and they have hardly any historic preservation whatsoever. Do you know what the historic preservation laws are like in SF?
Well, it's interesting. There, and again, I'm just going to keep going back to the symposium. We had Stephanie Cisneros gave a talk, and she's from the Historic Planning Department, and they actually do have a historic sign program. And if you can prove that it's 30 years old, and she often asks us to provide historic photos for proof, there's all kinds of limits on what you can do with that sign. And they try to work with the business owners, and if a compromise can be made, if a sign needs to be redesigned or moved, but they really don't let people just take them down and throw them in the trash.
Now, it's been a real positive change in city policy here, and we're really excited about that. That the city is actually making an effort to save signs I wouldn't say that was true 20 years ago or even 10 years ago.
And make an effort to work with business owners to make it work for their businesses rather than just having sometimes people feel like, oh, this preservation law doesn't really account for what I need to do with my business. The city's really trying to work with business owners and so far so good.
One case I heard about is there was this historic bar called the Gold Dust Lounge on Powell Street in Union Square, and it shut down and moved to Fisherman's Wharf, and it turned into a retail store, but they kept some degree of the marquee.
Yeah, and they never had much neon that I remember. I remember the Gold Dust, but
a couple old places that have basically, you know, been bought in Union Square, and then they try to move them to another location, and it just doesn't have the same feel. I would say that Lucky O'Jewels went that same route.
Yeah, they're out of business now. That was a great
baseball
bar and restaurant, yeah. And particularly if you were a baseball fan, because they had Lefty O'Dool had played for the Boston Red Sox, and he managed the San Francisco Seals in the old Pacific Coast League. And the bar that he owned, Lefty's, was full of baseball memorabilia. It was just like a museum. But they were victims of the times, and you know, couldn't agree on a price of a lease. And it's gone now. It's been gone for about 2 years.
And yeah, the building just sits empty.
Are there some good examples of 1950s diners in SF that have neon?
Well,
how about the St. Francis?
Oh, how about It's Tops?
It's Tops.
That's the classic one. We started a tour there. It's right on Market and Octavia. And it's got a really beautiful tall blade vertical sign.
Art Deco lettering.
And yeah, and then a little sign on the side that says It's Tops.
A little fascia sign.
Yeah.
And the signs went up, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere between 1947 and 1949. So and there
it's
still
family
owned
business. Yeah,
it's
still family owned. Sheila and Bruce.
I did mention Broadway and North Beach. One thing I noticed is a lot of those businesses, there's the Condor and Big Al's, that they changed ownership, but they kept the signs. So the Condor is now a sports bar, and Big Al's is now a deli. Or I think maybe a cigar shop or a deli, but they've managed to keep the signs.
Well, I don't know if you're remembering the famous Condor sign with Carol Doda, and her nipples were light bulbs that blinked.
That's easily okay. So that was before my time, but I've seen that in photographs.
So that's what we think of as the Condor sign, because it was trying to draw attention away from the Garden of Eden, the snake wrapped around the palm tree. That's still there.
Yeah.
That's one of the oldest signs on Broadway. Well, no, the oldest sign on Broadway is fascinating. It's the new Rex Hotel.
New Rex, yeah.
And it's in the shape of a submarine.
No, it's a
ship. Oh, what is it? It's a ship. That's what it is.
And that hasn't lit up in probably 30 years, but it's a beautiful sign. It's one of our favorites.
And clearly it was a hotel for sailors, huh?
Yeah.
With the ship.
When San Francisco still had, you know, a brisk port business.
How does that area manage? I mean, I mentioned the Tenderloin, which is a much lower income area. How does the whole North Beach, the whole Broadway strip manage to survive in such an expensive real estate?
Oh, good question. Well, you're in New York, right?
Southern California.
Southern California. Okay, well, we have our own version of what in New York they call the bridge and tunnel kids. And we have we have bridge kids here from coming from the suburbs on the weekends, and they really do fill North Beach. And so those businesses have, I think, a big part of their survival is based on the weekend traffic that they get from out-of-towners.
So it's not just historic preservation, it's economically viable in its own right, too.
Yeah.
And there are a lot more upscale restaurants along Broadway now. It's not all
bohemian
grand
artists,
houses and
yeah,
coffee
poets.
Houses. Yeah.
And there's a lot of neon up Columbus Street with the small cafes and bars.
Yeah, there's some great stuff. Not all of it lights up. La Pintura is there.
In the North Beach area.
In the North Beach area, yeah. I'm thinking of Gino and Carlo, Golden Boy Pizza.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Bimbo's 365 on Columbus.
Green Valley Restaurant. In fact, one of the restaurants, an old favorite in San Francisco, Original Joe's, they were into Tenderloin for many years, and they had a fire which pretty much forced them to relocate. They relocated to North Beach, and they brought their neon signs with them. And just the fact that they were able to do that, you know, working with the planning department and other city agencies, the fact that they were able to put those signs on the building was just remarkable.
And there's also a lot of signage on Fisherman's Wharf itself. I guess the best example would be Alioto's.
Yes.
Alioto's with their, they've got two or three beautiful fish.
And Fisherman's Grotto right next to it. Those are, and there's some of the bigger signs in San Francisco as well.
I love the oscillating light bulbs inside the number 9 for Fisherman's Grotto.
Then across the street you have something, this building that looks a little bit newer, like it could have, not really new, but maybe it was built in the 80s, 70s or 80s, that has a neon outline, like a pink neon outline.
I think there's some gift shops in that building.
If we're talking the same building.
But you know what, we can't overlook the View Alcatraz sign down in Fisherman's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great sign.
And it was restored right before our book was published. Someone had told us that it suddenly lit up after years, and it had never lit up, and we wanted to get it in the book. So Al called
called the Fisherman's Wharf Merchants Association.
Right, and said, we want to photograph this sign. Is there any way you can turn it on? And the woman's name was Pansy Tom.
Pansy Tom, and she left me a voice message and said, if you go down there tonight at 7 p.m., we'll turn the sign on for you. So we were able to squeeze that one into the book. We were really happy about that.
I think even the cannery itself has a neon sign.
Yeah, I think you're right, it does.
And Ghirardelli Square doesn't have a neon sign, but it has a bulb sign, which is excellent.
Yeah, yes. Excellent with channeled letters, and it's one of the rare roof signs in Fisherman's Wharf.
Was that part of the original chocolate factory, or was that added on when they renovated it into a shopping complex?
I haven't looked at a lot of photos, but I seem to remember seeing a photo of the chocolate factory, and it did not have a giant roof sign.
There's a lot of great bar signs throughout the city. I can think of one example is there's that bar in the Mission District which has the martini glass.
The 500 Club, biggest cocktail glass in neon in San Francisco.
We were there Saturday night.
Yeah, when we all the out-of-town speakers, that was, I think, kind of a real neon destination for them to go to the 500 Club.
Yeah, the mission has a number of bars, and then there's at least two theaters. I can forget the names, but there's a lot of theaters that have neon. And then
the Roxy has always had a neon sign glowing, and the new Mission was pretty recently restored.
Yeah, it was only about 3 years ago. Maybe 2 years ago. And that's a massive sign. And it's so big and it's so bright that you can see it from miles away, actually. If you're in the right part of town, if you're up on the hills, on Knob Hill, you know where the Mission's located, you look in that direction, and you will actually see the sign. And that's probably three to 4 miles away.
I think one of the Mission theaters, I forget which one, they're renovating it into an apartment complex, but they're keeping the blade of the sign.
It's going to be either the Grand or the Tower. I think those buildings actually still exist. The El Capitan still has a facade, but that's all behind it. It's a parking lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of gentrification in the Mission District.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I noticed that the last time I visited. Even an area, Cal Hollow, which is probably one of the most wealthiest parts of the city, there's still a high concentration of great signage.
High concentration. We always do tours there for the holidays when it gets dark really early. And it's kind of fun because it's theaters and motels.
Yeah, because part of that neighborhood is Lombard Street, which is actually part of the California State Highway System. It's Highway 101. So it's the one stretch in San Francisco where you have motels. It's probably, I think it's the second largest concentration of motels in the city. And so it has more of a highway or a roadside quality to some of the signage. So that's a fun tour to do.
And recently the El Sol Hotel, Del Sol Hotel, they repaired the diving lady that used to be on the front of the hotel. Now it's on the side, but it's really fun that lights up again.
Well, I think one of the largest signs in San Francisco is probably that giant Coca-Cola sign on the freeway and south of Market. I think that's even animated.
I think that's what, in the industry, they'd call a spectacular because it's so big. But we have heard from different sign people that is all LED now. And because it's so big...
Yeah, at least certain elements of it are definitely LED.
And if you look at some of the older photographs, there were a lot of really big signs like that back in the 50s.
Classic one was the Hams Brewery goblet of big goblet or glass of beer.
Well, beer aficionados would call it a chalice.
Okay.
But yes, that was a it was on the roof of the Hams Brewery, which was south of Market on Bryan Street. It was the largest commercial sign west of Chicago when it was installed in 1954. It had gold glass rings that it was actually a kinetic sign that it would fill and empty. So the gold rings would replicate the beer filling up the glass, and then the foam on the head of the beer was done by using 5,000 incandescent light bulbs. And unfortunately, that sign disappeared in about 1980, 82, 85.
We found just a little clip of it actually animating. That's how we know. And it was filmed for a little featurette that the government did of animated signs throughout the nation. And the Hams Brewery Chalice made the cut.
Yeah, it's a great little film. It's called Nightlights, and you can find it online. It was actually done by the federal government. It's just this whole survey of neon across the United States.
What are some older films that best capture neon in SF?
Lady from Shanghai.
Yeah, definitely Lady from Shanghai, with Orson Welles' film
with Rita Hayworth. Basically, Rita Hayworth chases Orson Welles all through Chinatown, and neon lights are everywhere, and she finally catches up with him in the Sun Sing Theater, which is no longer theater, but the facade is still there, and the metal sign that was neon is still there too. So that's one we'd really like to see restored.
And outside of San Francisco, there's a substantial number of great signs in Oakland and Berkeley.
And the peninsula, yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of signage in Oakland.
Now, it's not there's not that much of it that lights up, except really right there in downtown Oakland. And, of course, the Paramount Theater is the biggest, most spectacular neon sign of any theater in the Bay Area, rivaled closely by the Grand Lake Theater.
On Grand Avenue, yeah. In fact, the Paramount has over 7,000 feet of glass on it.
There's also the Orinda Theater. Then there's the Rhein Theater in Moraga, which is also in Contra Costa County. But I was reading somewhere that the Rhein Theater recently closed. Do you know if they're going to demolish it or preserve it?
We heard that it was not going to be preserved unless it got somebody changed their mind at the last minute.
Was that from the 50s?
I don't know. It's not always easy to date signs. I'm going to guess a little earlier, because that was the heyday of theater neon signs, was more in the 30s and 40s.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Tom Rinaldi in his great book. Tom, because of his work with architects and as an architectural designer, he is very talented at finding records and, you know, in building records and planning records.
Permits.
For New York signs. He's amazing, the information he can get. But here in San Francisco, it's been a lot more difficult to determine, you know, who the sign manufacturer was, who applied for the original permit to install the sign. We just haven't been able to dig deep enough to get that kind of information like Tom does.
Do you think part of it could be that the Rheem Theater is in a more remote location, so there's less awareness of it?
You know, I don't think a remote location really is a factor. It's really whether or not the person that owns it understands the value of what they already own.
And of course, and can they afford it?
Yeah.
Because it's you know, yeah. Signs of that size, they're not cheap, and it's expensive to maintain them.
And, you know, often the cheapest thing to do is, of course, is nothing. And even just paint, you know, just if you want to restore a sign, you don't necessarily have to restore the glass. Sometimes painting it is the best answer for the time being until there's enough business activity to afford to put the neon tubes back in the glass. But what we hate to see is when the signs are just defaced or completely redesigned with absolutely no concern or idea of what the historical value of the design of the sign is.
And on the other hand, you can go the opposite route where you can leave the peeling paint and the faded patina and just install new glass. So there are different schools of thought on that. There are preservationists who prefer one method over the other. But.
And I think most people who are interested in sign preservation will almost always tell you it's a case-by-case basis on what's best for that business and whatever condition the sign is in.
And the other theater I mentioned was the Orinda Theater. That's definitely more Art Deco, but you can notice that at night driving on the freeway.
Yes, yeah. That's great you know that theater. That's a beautiful theater, beautiful neon.
And I think the owners really value what they have.
Have you thought about making a book that covers the signs outside San Francisco, the Bay Area in general?
Well, we almost have all the photographs we need to do that. But the more we do our advocacy work and preservation work, we realize, you know, the way to save signs is when people get activated in their own individual cities. So we actually would rather see, you know, people in individual cities do books about those cities and the neon signs there, because it actually, you know, that's what kind of turns the tide of people realizing they have something valuable to save. You know, if we did a book on all of California, which would be really, really fun, but it wouldn't have the impact if there are individual books about individual places, which really have to be done by the people who live there.
Yeah, not to say we don't photograph neon everywhere we go.
We do. And we're not alone. There's a really wonderful group of very good photographers called the Sign Geeks, and they actually travel around in packs to document all these beautiful roadside architecture and signs. And the way they're creating their archive is through hashtags. And hashtag SignGeek is one way to see all those great photos.
And yet with San Francisco, it's just so remarkable, the sheer concentration with a lot of these others. With a lot of these other towns throughout the Bay Area, there's some remarkable signs, but it's more spread out, so maybe it will get attention by the local community. Have you heard about some of the community responses? And like I gave that example with the Ream Theater. Was there any interest in saving it?
Well, I don't really know the particulars of the Ream Theater, but one sign that we have been involved in is the Carlos Club in San Carlos. And a new owner bought it, and because it has the name of the town, it was always considered a landmark and an icon. And he bought the business and wanted to change the name of the business, which meant that he had to cover up this big, beautiful Art Deco sign with a tarp, which just seemed really counterproductive to business. And when it was underneath the tarp, somehow the neon just disappeared, even though it has some kind of protected status.
Yeah, that's been a political nightmare down there, because people really did were really proud of that sign, and it was considered a landmark for decades. And so there was a moveon.org petition?
I forget petition. I forget the petition site name.
And it was signed by people from all over the United States, preservationists, historians, just regular folks.
And we all showed up at a city council meeting, and the city council decided that the owner needed to restore the sign to the
original look.
Look when he bought it, and that was 2 years ago, and it still hasn't happened. And we don't really have a good reason, a good answer from the city council why nothing has happened yet.
Santa Cruz is actually a great place for neon. I'm thinking of the boardwalk in particular, which is probably one of the last surviving great boardwalks in California, but there's also a lot of great theaters downtown.
Yes, they're on Pacific Avenue. There's a beautiful theater.
The Del Mar.
The Del Mar. They have a gorgeous neon on that building. And then right above the boardwalk is an area, a neighborhood called Beach Hill. And there's four or five really beautiful neon signs tucked away up there.
For motels and apartments, they're really a kind of all of the same look. So, you know, sometimes you'll say, like, neighborhood architecture will all be of the same style. That's definitely true of the style of neon signs in the Beach Hill area.
Have you found that some cities are more receptive to historic preservation? I'm not talking so much on a nationwide level, but in Northern California in general?
Oh, well, in Northern California, I think right now San Francisco is, happily for us, the most receptive. But I know on a nationwide level, the city of Tucson's done an amazing job with neon restorations, in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And absolutely in Denver. Corky Scholl has the Save the Signs organization there, and there's so many signs on Colfax Avenue, which is one of the longest commercial strips in the country, I think.
It's like 24 or 26 miles long.
And he's really had the support of the city council to preserve the history and the signs on Colfax, and they have some beautiful signs. The Satire Lounge and Pete's Kitchen are two that have been recently restored, all the neons restored, but now they also animate. And that was all done by the Gordon Sign Company, which is one of the oldest sign companies that's been in continuance, been operating continually in the United States.
Yeah, those animated signs have become pretty rare. Would you say that the Coca-Cola sign, which you mentioned is LED, that's probably one of the last major surviving ones in the Bay Area. I can think of, I know the one at the Madonna Inn in San Luis Obispo is animated, but overall those signs have become really rare. They're mostly from the 50s.
Well, I just got to say the Castro animates because it's spelled Castro, and that's a big sign.
And the Roxy is a speller as well.
Yeah, and the Roxy is a speller at well. But yeah, they're very rare, particularly if there's some kind of animation in it, like Pete's Kitchen. And I know, like in San Francisco, the zoning is you can't have an animated sign except on Broadway, interesting enough. But as far as we know, that's not enforced.
There's no enforcer for that ordinance there. Yeah. But I think that's a lot of why you see less and less of the flashers and the spellers and the chasers, you know, the animated signs. A lot of it has to do with zoning and building codes and, you know, district codes. So.
And when you think about Tad Steaks, that's an amazing animated sign, as well as the number 9 down at Fisherman's Grotto. And still blinking away.
I think even the Roaring Twenties on Broadway is that might be animated.
I think the dancer, she kicks her leg.
She does. That's right.
Can you talk about Jim Rizzo of Neon Works in Oakland? And he's been rescuing and restoring signs for decades.
That guy's crazy about signs.
Yeah. In fact, we did an event in his shop just yesterday afternoon. We did two tours, and they both sold out. People are amazed by what they saw. He had his tube bender, Amy Palms, demonstrated tube bending for people. Jim talked about the sign business. He talked about the signs that he has in his personal collection. It was a really great event, and everyone went home happy.
Yeah, we drove around the Tenderloin with him looking for signs, and we're looking up on buildings. Jim is looking on the ground to see if there's any low-hanging fruit. Huh. And sure enough, he found a parking sign, beautiful neon parking sign that was on the ground in a parking garage. And he pulls over and runs in and talks to the parking lot manager. And he says, what are you going to do with that sign? Can I have it? And they're like, yeah, take it away. And that's how Jim saved signs.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to what a lot of museums have been doing. You mentioned the one in L.A. I grew up in L.A. I never got a chance to go there. I definitely should. I know there's the famous Neon Boneyard in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. I haven't actually been there on a tour, but I did get to drive by it at night.
Good. Yeah, you know, and I guess we should set the record straight. The MoNA in L.A. is actually in the city of Glendale.
Mm-hmm. But, and it's a museum of neon art, and the one in Las Vegas is the Neon Museum, and it's really strictly signs, whereas the one in Glendale is both about vintage signs and actual art made out
sculptors.
Of neon, yeah.
They just did a MoNA-sponsored show and did an exhibit called She Bends, which featured, I think, 22 women tube benders who do sculptures. And luckily that show is in San Francisco right now at the Midway Gallery.
Midway Gallery. And now the current show at MoNA, we're dying to see this. It's basically all signs curated by Eric Linksweiler, who wrote wrote an essay for our book and does the tours. And he really features a lot of motel signs and a couple of signs that were rescued from San Francisco, like the Tip Top Inn. So, yeah, we're excited to see those signs restored. Oh, and Oakland, the Burgermeister one, he basically pulls the tap, fills the beer, and turns and smiles at you. It's a great animated sign.
Are there any examples of newer businesses creating new signs from scratch?
Sure. Stuckey's Club Moderne. They have an Art Deco neon sign now on the corner of their building.
What area is that in?
It's Bush and Taylor.
Oh, cool.
And so it's right by the old Key Club sign, which is an old neon sign, and very close to the Cottage Market, which is, again, just a classic porcelain enamel sign.
And the Cottage Market is very close to the Grand Hotel, which has a classic neon sign from the 50s.
Which is next to the City Services sign and the Paragon sign. Bush Street's just got some great vintage signs, so Stuckey's signs just fits right in.
Are you talking about Bush Street near Union Square?
A little bit up. We call that area the Tender Knob because it's between the Tenderloin and Knob Hill.
So you're saying that area probably has the highest concentration in the whole city?
No.
Not as much as Chinatown, but we do a Tender Knob tour, and we're really walking, you know, O'Farrell, Geary, Post, Sutter, and Bush. And so those are all corridors leading away from Union Square. And again, they're all studio or one-bedroom apartments where all the workers live that traditionally work in the Union Square area or downtown in the high-rises.
How did the Neon Symposium Festival go? That was fairly recently.
Yesterday. Actually, the last couple of days. And the idea for the symposium, the spark of it, came from Todd Swarmstedt, who is the founder of the American Sign Museum in Cincinnati. And we had some questions for Todd. He's just an expert in preservation and he's got a Save Old Signs, his SOS project. And he got us on the phone and we were talking a little bit, and he said, I'd love to come out and do a talk about historic neon preservation for you. Just find a history museum someplace to host it and I'll come out.
And we did.
we contacted the Tenderloin Museum. It's a fairly new museum in the Tenderloin. That's where so many neon signs are.
Right, and they agreed to be our fiscal sponsor so we could receive grant funding.
And Katie Connery is the executive director, and she didn't even hesitate for a second. She just thought it was a great match for their mission and what we were trying to do.
Yeah. So the conference was started on this past Friday and concluded yesterday. We had a number of speakers from around the country. Corky Scholl, who Randall mentioned earlier, came out from Denver. Todd Swarmstedt came from Cincinnati. Deborah Jane came up from Southern California.
Eric came from MoNA. And our local was John Law.
And don't forget Will Durham. There's a guy in Reno, Nevada, Will Durham, who has been saving signs on his own, at his own expense, for over 20 years, storing them in friends' garages and backyards, anywhere he can, warehouses. And his ultimate goal is to create a neon museum in Reno.
And really, he's busted his knuckles every time he's saved a sign. He really just kind of does it. He's a one-man sign saver. And as he said, he really hasn't... He got them all the classic signs of Reno. He would buy them and ask them to be kept in place until the building was going to be demolished. So he tried to keep them in place as long as possible. But now he's saved them, and at some point he's going to make them available for the public to see.
And his stories of his adventures and misadventures alone are worth a book. Incredibly funny stories about his whole restoration project. So we're wishing him luck, and it was great to have him at the conference as well, because he's coming from a very different approach to preservation than most people.
I've been to Las Vegas many times, and there's still a lot of signage in the Fremont Street area. I've never been to Reno, but from what I've heard, they've lost most of their original bunch of signage.
They've lost a considerable amount. They have.
But
in a sense, they're not lost because Will Durham still has them.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the redevelopment there has been vast. They've just been scraping whole
blocks.
And Reno's definitely reinventing itself, which is, you know, that's natural and it happens. But thanks to one guy, a lot of their neon history was not thrown in the garbage.
Have you noticed a big increase in interest in saving neon signs in, say, the last 10 years?
I would say the last 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah, I think since we did our book, when we published our book, there have been close to 30 restoration projects in San Francisco alone. And I know down in Fresno, California, a lot of the signs there, they had an old motel row, which was not a place you'd want to spend the night in its later years. But there were some great neon signs there, and other signs from the city of Fresno have ended up in the county fairgrounds where they've been restored and are on display.
Well, when you think about it, the Museum of Neon Art, Eric's been doing that tour for 18 years. So they've been preserving and restoring signs way ahead of everybody else.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Randall Ann Homan and Al Barna for being on. It's been an excellent show.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And if the audience is interested in getting involved and checking out your work, what is the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, sfneon.org is our website, and that's, of course, SF for San Francisco. And also, we've got our tours listed on Eventbrite, and almost anytime we do a neon event, you'll find it on Eventbrite.